It's Primus Tracks with Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates, Primus fans, old and new. You've reached Primus Tracks. We're at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. I am Josh, and sitting right over there is Frankie, the Encyclopedia Beristein. How are you?
Thank you, Josh. Fine.
Today we're talking about the fourth track of Frizzle Fry, Mr. Know-It-All. And I have a question for you, Frankie, and that is, because I'm a fan of language and knowing how to say things in different ways, how would you call someone a know-it-all in a slightly rude fashion in Espanol?
How would I call someone a know-it-all in Spanish?
Yeah.
The direct translation would be sabelo todo.
Now, is that a common phrase, or is there a different kind of idiom? Is there something similar in Spanish that you know of?
That's the closest translation.
If you say that and have a sarcastic look on your face, you'll get the message across.
For sure.
Good. These are the little things I need to know, because I want to be rude to people all over the world.
Okay.
I want them to... No, I'm kidding. You satisfied my curiosity. Thank you. Hey, we've got something else to do right here off the top. If you are a loyal listener of this podcast, you can go to Apple Podcast and leave a review. I read them. So if you want to try to make me cry, go ahead. But you can also leave nice words if you like. And we actually have our first five-star review and rating. And we got it on April 20th from Travis AK. And Travis AK, thank you, by the way. And he says, it's about time. Finally, a music podcast worth listening to. I love listening to people talk so passionately about something I myself am so passionate about. So looking forward to more. Thanks, guys.
Wow, Travis, thank you so much. That's really kind. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And you can make our podcast easier for Primus fans to find by leaving a five-star review on Apple Podcasts. And I will read it with my melodious voice on the air, even if you say something hurtful. So head on over and do that, and maybe we'll make that a regular feature of the show. We are talking today about the fourth track from the wonderful Frizzle Fry album, and that is Mr. Know-It-All.
I'd like to start off, Josh, by saying that this is one of my favorite Primus tracks of all time. I simply love this track.
Wow.
It's so heavy. It's such a showstopper live also. You know, as soon as Les sings the opening verse, people go crazy. And that might have something to do with the fact that it's such a rarity nowadays. But regardless of that, it's always been a hard-hitting track when it's performed live. We'll go deeper into the live performances later, but I just want to start off by saying that I absolutely love this song. It's one of my favorite Primus songs of all time. And as far as the origin of the track goes, according to our reliable toaster, first performance of the track dates back to 1989 at the Sacramento Club in California. Well, at the Cactus Club in Sacramento, California. After that, it became a pretty regular track during the 90s. There's an unusual performance by the Yellow Sock on June 29th, 1990. As you know, this is the acoustic Primus, so they adapted the song to a jazz format, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, the structure of the song is there. They just play it like a jazz version, and it's really mind-blowing. Other than that, the track, as I mentioned, it was on heavy rotation throughout the 90s. It was played considerably less as the 90s advanced, though. I can only see two performances in 1996 and two performances in 1998. After that, it disappeared from the set lists until its return for Tour de Fromage.
Wow. This is our first relative rarity, given the info we have.
It is.
As far as catalog performances, there are only 178, which puts it pretty far down the list. I think More on TV has more performances, live performances, than this song, which is incredible.
It's kind of strange, right? Because, I mean, it's such an incredible song, and the people always react really well to it. So it makes you wonder why Les doesn't play it more often.
Yeah. I think as we discuss what's going on in this song, maybe we'll uncover why. Because it is, as you said, it's heavy and hard hitting. It might just be really hard to play. I'm not sure.
There are two really amazing performances that I would like to mention.
Sure.
One of them belongs to Tour de Fromage, and it took place in Davis, California. This is a particularly interesting show. Are you familiar with this show, Josh?
I was just running back through some of the Fromage set list, and the Davis one, gosh, I don't remember anything from it off the top of my head.
Les was sick during this show. His voice was pretty shut. So for that reason, they adapted set one to his condition. So they tried to jam the songs as much as possible so he wouldn't have to sing a lot during set one. For that reason, you have a really, really long spaghetti western on set one. And there's also a hamburger train, which was the only performance of that track during Tour de Fromage. But the reason that I mentioned this show is that the encore for this particular concert was Mr. Know-It-All, and it's a really, really amazing version of Mr. Know-It-All. It even has a mistake. Les forgets the lyrics during the second verse, and he stops the track completely, and the people start yelling, "You suck." But then... He picks up the lyrics again and they continue with the track. But I mean, regardless of that, it's a pretty incredible performance of the song. And there's another performance of the track that I really love, and this one is from, it's actually from the Hallucinogenetics portion of the tour.
Oh.
And it took place at the Seahawks Auditorium. Are you familiar with this show?
I am not.
There's nothing particular that stands out about the show setlist wise, just that they performed the tracks really at the top of their game. If you listen to set two, Frizzle Fry, in its entirety, it's kind of more aggressive than other performances of the album during this tour. They really injected the songs with a lot of heaviness, and You can hear that particularly in Mr. Know-It-All, because during the bridge, Les puts a ton of distortion on his bass, so it sounds incredibly heavy. So those are my two favorite performances of Mr. Know-It-All. I'm pretty lucky that I have seen Mr. Know-It-All live once.
Absolutely, yeah. If you got it, you are... as we said, it's kind of a rarity, so if you've got it, good for you. I've actually seen it 5 times. I was surprised.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a good batting average, considering. I always go back to the Milwaukee Fromage show. We've talked about that show quite a bit, actually, already, but the I'm going to drop in a little bit from that show, because I believe we get a semi-sincere commentary as to how this track came about. So I'll drop that in and you'll get some commentary from Les Claypool over some bizarre instrumentation.
I'd like to play a song for you. It's a song that's very special to me. We don't play it very often. Mr.
Mr. Know-It-All. I will not compromise. I will not be told what to do. I shall not step aside.
The other thing is this, there's also a professionally, or at least it sounds professionally, professionally recorded live version of this track that made it onto Music for Our Mother Ocean, which is a 1996 compilation. And that's in that time frame where we were talking, we asked Soya, was there a live album in the works at that time? And he wasn't sure, but if Primus had this cut laying around and it sounds really good, and you can find it on YouTube, just search for Music for Our Mother Ocean, Primus, and you'll get it. I wonder if this was one of the recordings that was being considered for that mythical live album.
It does sound pretty great. I mean, after all, it's a soundboard recording, but it's a particularly great performance of the song. And as you mentioned, it would be weird for them to have a recording of Mr. Know-It-All lying around for no reason. I recall a live album being discussed, and you recall it as well. I think the odds are that it must have been mentioned at some point. And what we were able to, I mean, we couldn't trace back the interview, but I'm able to recall either Tim Alexander or Lur discussing the possibility of putting out a live album from Tales from the Punch Bowl. Now, what I don't remember is if they were planning to pick a particular concert and release the concert as a live CD, or if they were actually picking tracks from different shows to build a CD with the best performances from the tour. What I do recall is that, I don't know if it was either Les or Tim who said that they felt most of the performances were really boring. Do you recall that?
Yeah, and I think that was a Les Claypool quote, but I could be wrong, because we're talking about 25 years ago at this point. But I swear that there was a Billboard post from 25 – I'm dating myself, but I was a teenager then, so whatever. But I swear there was a Billboard post at some point where somebody mentioned, oh, yeah, and Tim's working on a live album. So I remember that, but I don't know if I made that up at this point. So if you've been around Primus for 25, 30 years and you were hanging out on the internet doing weird shit with me, let us know, please, because I have this specific memory. And, you know, maybe we'll solve the mystery of the live album that never was. Big time props to Matt Weiniger and Ron Rigler, our producer and engineer for Frizzle Fry, because they helped the band get this crushing sound to this track. You were pointing to it earlier, Frankie. Tim's drums sound huge. And Larry, he's not always on top of everything in the mix, but here it does kind of seem like he is. And, you know, they easily could have let everything get muddied up during that big percussive breakdown or bridge that you mentioned earlier. But it's really all clear and it's really nice and punchy. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why it really holds up for me, because from a production standpoint, it sounds fantastic and you can hear every little thing.
I absolutely agree. The production on the studio cut is top-notch.
Yeah, and there was a recently unearthed or released interview from 1994 in which Les Claypool said he's a very percussive bass player, and he's always watching other bands' drummers. And I think this is our first real glimpse, as far as studio tracks go, with Mr. Know-It-All being a shining example of his percussive bass playing, given that he's doing a lot of right-hand tapping on the fretboard.
It does. You know what? There are, I think, two distinctive performances where you can get a pretty good close-up of his technique on that track. One of them is, both are on YouTube, but one of them goes way back. I think it's from 1991, and it's a performance at a television program called La Estampa. It kind of cuts into the song. It's not recorded from the beginning, but a lot of the video focuses on the fretboard from Les's bass, so you can actually see how he plays the track.
Oh, very good. So aspiring bass players, or those of you that want to play it exactly, give that one a look. And that's actually incredible for 1991, because usually he's spinning around in circles while he's playing this tune at that point in time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And there's also a really cool performance from Outside Lands, 2008. You know, they busted that track on the set list, and I particularly like that performance because Les used distortion in the bridge again, you know, but not the heavy kind. He kind of gave the strings like this weird effect. They sound like they are made of rubber during the bridge. So it's a pretty cool performance of the track as well.
Nice. That's one to look for. I remember that Outside Lands performance. I think I was either streaming it or I was just watching it after the fact, but I was working late, and that was my soundtrack for networking a bunch of computers under desks and that sort of thing and getting very dirty. But that carried me through, I remember. So that got me through that horrible, horrible night. We mentioned the right hand tapping technique that Les is using. Larry carries the melody. He doesn't always do that, but in this point in time, he is. You know, Les has mentioned in that he normally plays with textural guitarists, but this one, Larry's on top of things and he's carrying that melody. I really like that little tremolo dip in his main riff. I love that touch, and it's just a little thing, but it's one of my favorite things in this song. Tim hits those double bass drums. When he goes double bass, it's just the right times to accent that they're building for something. When they are in the main riff for one round, and I couldn't tell you after which verse it is, Tim gets away from the hi-hat, and he's keeping time with the toms. And then he starts doing those double gocks on the snare too. And I'm not going to sit here and sing the drums.
I was just about to mention that. Yeah. I mean, Tim is a really amazing drummer, but, you know, it's always caught my attention how that's one of the things that make the studio cut particularly amazing. The snare work from Tim on the track, particularly after the third verse. And if you listen or you watch performances from the early days, he replicated that in the performances, but for some reason, he doesn't do that anymore.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have to listen to some recent performances and compare. It is a very busy tune for him. He is working overtime on this one.
Yeah, and you know, it's never been a track that Primus jams out or particularly extends, but what they do is that during the quiet parts, they give Tim some room to show off some ghost notes.
Right, yeah, there's little nice drum breaks in there that he gets to do his thing. For those of us that don't know what ghost notes are, can you explain that?
The way that I understand the concept is that a drummer is doing fills and, you know, these subtle changes in rhythm or melody to make a song more interesting. That's my concept for ghost notes. Mm-hmm. Am I correct?
It's good enough for me, Frankie. You could have told me like his drum set was haunted and I would have believed you. Like, yeah, that's what ghost notes are. The angry spirits of, no, that sounds right to me. But when we get somebody with actual real musical knowledge on, they can help us out. But, you know, as far as this song structure goes, it's very simple, because they separate things out. We have words, then music, then words, then music, then words, then music and a solo and a badass bridge, and then more words and then more music. And then the song's over. But they vary it, and we were going in that direction. When the music's going, they vary it enough each time. So it's not just the same thing over and over again, and it definitely comes from Tim, who's really driving this tune.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And talking about the lyrics, once again, they are pretty clever lyrics.
They sure are. And it's just five stanzas. There aren't a ton of lyrics to this song. If you don't mind me going into English teacher mode, we have an ABCB rhyme scheme, except for the punchline at the end, which uses the repetition, which is fine. You know, there's no rules. The meter is really interesting. It's kind of like, I'm going to sound like an idiot when I do this, but it's kind of, when he says, they call me Mr. Know-it-all, I will not compromise. He's kind of going, bup, 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 you know, so there's a little bit of it's not just straight ahead. And he even gets in, and I'm really going deep on this one. I believe without realizing it, Mr. Les Claypool was using some trochees and iambic tetrameter in one couplet. Listen to me. So this one couplet, I could tell such wondrous tales. You can hear the stress on the first foot of the syllabic pair, right? I could tell such wondrous tales. We're getting that troche there. And then he shifts in the second part of it with, if I should find the time, So the stress is on the second foot of it, and that's the iamb, where he starts to sound like the famous iambic pentameter from Romeo and Juliet, right? Shall I compare to wow. the summer's day? Okay? That's like the most famous one. If I should find, it's just a little thing. If I should find the time. And I don't think he was doing that consciously, but he shifts how he's stressing those feet, to use a literary term that don't make, that doesn't make sense.
Well, there's, I just checked, and there seems to be a whole lot of controversy online regarding what is a ghost note, but some guy said that a ghost note is one that is played really lightly. It's more implied than anything else.
Yes, that makes more sense. I can dig that.
And they said that a lot of times they are just there because during the passage of the song that has it, for whatever reason, the musician made that note sound. And usually very faintly.
So Tim does, like, even though he's a thunderous drummer, he can kind of tiptoe over things sometimes, and that's what it sounds like. It's just a little hit here or there.
Yeah, actually, I remember seeing a drum cover of My Name is Mutt on YouTube. The guy that was playing the song, you know, he was just keeping the beat of the song during the verses, but he said, this is a lot harder than it looks. I think he meant that he's not just keeping the beat, you know. There are a ton of little details and feels throughout the song, and that's something very characteristic from Tim Alexander.
It probably looks easier than it is, and it often sounds easier than it is, because I remember thinking the same thing, going, these guys are great musicians, but this sounds simple. And then you actually watch them play, you're going to work your ass off to even come close. And that just shows the
totally.
Talent. Yeah, this just shows the talent of this band, and this is one of the reasons I love them so much. And we're sitting here talking about them and recording it and putting it on the internet, for crying out loud.
Something that can attest to the absolute talent and technical virtuosity of Primus is the fact that there are a ton of Primus songs and also Les Claypool songs which have never been covered on YouTube. There are tracks for which you simply cannot find a person doing a cover.
Yeah, especially, there are some where there just absolutely are none. But then there are the ones that are covered a lot, and most of them are covered incorrectly or just downright poorly, because it's just
like
that hard.
Like Tommy the Cat, for instance.
Yeah, that's a huge one. Every once in a while, you see these compilation videos. Oh, I'm playing 10 crazy Primus riffs. And I'm like, hey, good job, you got 7 of them wrong. First of all, you know, like, why are you playing Jerry on a 4-string, first of all, dude? You know, like, you're already, come on. So, just to come right back around to the lyrics, you're right. It is a clever, there are some clever lyrics going on. There is no big statement about the world we live in this one, unlike, say, To Defy the Laws of Tradition, Too Many Puppies. And there, it really isn't semi-autobiographical like Groundhog's Day. But it really is fun, and I have to say this, Frankie, it really is fun to see a smarmy prick get busted up every once in a while. And that's what's happening at the end, and I love
and,
it.
I mean, it does make you wonder if it's something like Sergeant Baker, which is not an actual person, but it's a composite of different people, or if it's an actual person that Les met and he was describing in the song. You know, I've gone through a lot of interviews, and I don't know if you have ever been able to find something, but I don't recall ever reading Les talk about this track in detail, you know, like describing who the song is about or if it's just a fictional character.
Yeah, I never have either. I would assume this is just something that sprung from his head as opposed to him retelling an experience.
Oh, I guess the closest that we have is that Fromage performance where he introduces the track very ominously, you know, with a lot of atmospheric bass sounds. And he says that it's a song about a man on a journey who ultimately finds himself. It kind of makes you wonder if he was just joking, though.
Well, that's what I think. He might have just been screwing around, but there's something there to it. You know, it doesn't strike me as totally facetious, but you never know. So we've talked a little bit about our personal connections with this tune. I want to briefly touch on something that happened to me. When I was an undergrad many years ago, I was hanging out with guys that mostly listened to Dave Matthews Band and, I don't know, John Mayer, if he was around. I don't know if he was. you know, every once in a while, like, they'd be like, Rage Against the Machine, woo! And I'd be like, okay, sure. But mostly they were into this non-aggressive music. So, but as often happens in one's 20s, you're in a car with three other dudes on a road trip. They finally, after years of hearing me preach about this band, they said, okay, let's hear it. So I put in Frizzle Fry, and it's the middle of the night. We're going through Indiana or Ohio or something, and I figure I was driving, so I figure they're not going to throw me out if I do this. So I felt safe. So I put it on. We made it almost all the way through the album. And one of the guys was a drummer, and he was really impressed with Tim's skill, but he thought that as a whole, that everything was just too much. When this track, Mr. Know-It-All, came down, I don't remember which guy it was, but they said, can you turn that down a little bit? and then I found myself arguing with them, like, no, you got to listen to this, because all these wonderful pieces come together, and this is only three guys making all this noise. And listen to Tim, he's so busy with these fills and filling the space. And my friend that was a drummer said, you know, busy isn't always ideal. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But in this track, it's necessary, you know, save it for something else. So this is a track I tried to use, or one of many tracks I tried to use to get people into Primus, and it didn't very much work.
There are two really interesting things that you mentioned in your anecdote. First of all, I can totally relate. I've been told probably a million times to turn the volume down on Primus in different places.
Beautiful.
You know, the word that they use to describe Primus, BC, it's strange for me how people would use that word in a negative way to describe Primus, because for me it's precisely the fact that their music is so busy what makes it fascinating. I have a tendency to get really bored quickly with music when it's really simple. I mean, that doesn't mean that I don't enjoy it. I can perfectly enjoy pop music or traditional verse chorus songs, but there's a point when I get bored with them. And I've been listening to Primus since I was 13 years old, and I haven't gotten bored with their music for even a single day. And I think it's the fact that it's so busy, it has your brain working at top speed all the time. You know, there are so many things that you can concentrate on when you listen to their songs. Maybe you can choose to concentrate on the drums or the bass or the ghost notes or the fills or the jams in the live versions. But there's so much to take in that there is no room to get bored with their music. So for me, when people describe Primus as BC, I say, yeah, that's exactly the reason why I love Primus.
Right on, man. You're preaching to the choir, but I think the choir is loving it. I think you're on to it, because that complexity in there's always something new to listen to. Even if you've listened to it 100 times, you can still go back and marvel at it, and it's really fun to do.
One of the reasons that it's so enjoyable is that it's something really organic, because there are plenty of technical bands that set out to be technical. You know, they create their music with a technical basis, and that's how they want to play it. But in the case of Primus, they don't get together and say, let's make this track, you know, as technical as possible or as difficult to play as we can. I think the technicality in their music is something that just comes out naturally when they play together. Les is not someone who, you know, who's going to play a BC bass line throughout the entire song. He knows precisely what parts require some virtuosism and in which parts to be more rhythmical. So I think that Primus is indeed a technical band, but it's an organic one. So there is no pretension in their playing. It's just the way that they play their songs. They couldn't play them any other way, even if they tried.
Amen. Last thing I'm going to say, and I know that the band listens to this podcast faithfully, so I'm going to ask you guys more live performances, please. And in case you're wondering, words that rhyme with eloquent, elegant, relevant, elephant, take your pick. I think they're all nice.
I second that request. It would be really great to hear Mr. Know-It-All more often live. It's just a fantastic track.
Mr. Know-It-All, well, to put it eloquently, you've been tracked. Thanks for listening. We're going to be back with the title track to Frizzle Fry. I can't remember the name of it right now, but that's okay. We've got a few days. Keep listening. Go to Apple Podcasts, 5-star review. I would love to read your review on the air. Frankie, it's been a pleasure.
The same, Josh.
Later days.
Willie Mays.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.